And I have been with Insights for like 12 years, and I've been teaching for like 7 years, but I haven't taught yet this year. So some of you are new, and some of you probably don't know me, and I don't know you, so hello, nice to meet you. I am married to Greg, and we have 4 kids. So that's Christmas Eve. We were all together, which is very fun for Christmas, and that's taken down in the lobby here, Christmas Eve service. But if you know my kids, that's really just a very nice picture of my kids. This is really my kids. That was like a few minutes after that picture was taken. And Greg and I often laugh because we actually have 2 sets of kids, really, because Gabe and Allie, the older two, are 22 and 20. And Grant and Annie, the younger two up there, are 15 and 14. And so there's this big gap in between. So we have these 2 sets of kids. And Gabe and Allie's personalities are very similar. They're very much alike. Grant and Annie's personalities are very similar. But the 2 sets could not be more opposite. I've got my extroverts and my older kids and my introverts and my younger kids, and they couldn't be more different. Gabe and Allie were really into theater in high school. They did all that stuff at Rochester High School. And I did theater when I was in high school, so I jumped right in as the theater mom. When they got involved, I was that mom, the mom that drove everyone else nuts. I was in charge of all the ticket sales and all of the concessions, and if the kids needed food, if the cast needed it, I was the one bringing food, and all the parents would come to me with questions, and I had all the answers, and I had keys to the offices, and I was the theater mom. And I loved it. Those were my people. I was very comfortable there. And then Allie graduated from high school one spring, and the very next fall, Grant started high school, my second set, and guess what? Grant plays football, and Annie's a cheerleader. I don't know anything about football, just ask Grant, he'll tell you, that I know nothing about football, I don't know anything about cheer, and I had to trade in my cushy seat in the climate-controlled auditorium for the cold bleachers, and I don't know what's going on, I don't know what kind of I'm supposed to buy him a mouth guard and all this different kinds of gear, and there's Nike and, Under Armour, and I was just lost. I didn't know what I was doing. I noticed that there's all these other parents who are going to things called booster meetings. I'm like, what's a booster? What's going on? And they were running galas and raising money and making posters, and I'm completely out of it. And I realized, high school athletics is a little culture in and of itself, isn't it? And then I realized, high school theater is a little culture in and of itself. One I was comfortable with, one I wasn't. But I also, I had this aha moment when I realized there are different times in our lives when God places us in different little cultures, right? We're in that culture for a while, and we have a really cool opportunity to reach the people in that culture for Jesus while we're there. I just thought, wow, that's amazing. Today's, when we open up in Acts with Paul, Paul finds himself in a really different culture, doesn't he? When we start and open in chapter 17, Paul finds himself in Athens. And he's all alone. He's just been in Berea, and then there were some nasty guys from Thessalonica who came down and started making trouble for him in Berea, so he had to really quick escape down to Athens, remember that? So he's by himself, and he's in this culture, and it's different, and it's really interesting to watch and see what he does in this different culture. I've always been intrigued by this little passage, so we're actually going to camp right there on Paul in Athens, and we're not even, which was day 1 of your homework, I think. We're not even looking at day 2 through 5, so just pack that away in your brain if you had questions, too bad. We're not even going there. So we're going to look at day 1, and we're going to see exactly what Paul did while he was in Athens, and we're going to take a page from what I am calling Sharing Jesus with Your Culture for Dummies. Helpful hints from the Apostle Paul. You've seen those for dummy books, right? They have them on like every subject under the sun. And so I picked this for dummies theme, mostly because I just thought it was fun and cute, why not? But also because those books are great. They take something that's complicated and kind of make it simple. They give you just a few simple ideas on one subject, and that's what we're going to do today. We're going to look at Paul, what he did in Athens with the culture that he had there, and hopefully we can gain some simple ideas on what we can do in some of the cultures we find ourselves in. So let's start by looking at the story. We start right at chapter 17, verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, and them is, I forget, Titus, Timothy, or somebody, waiting for them to join him, he was deeply troubled by all the idols he saw everywhere in the city. He went to the synagogue to reason with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and he spoke daily in the public square to all who happened to be there. So let's stop here and get a little perspective. What do we know about Athens? Well, Athens is the oldest named city in the world, which is quite a heritage for Athens. It was the center of philosophy and art and architecture and religion well before Paul's time. Actually, by the 5th century BC, it had gained that prestige in the world. They were the first to set up a form of government that we now base our democracy on here in America. And actually, they were so advanced in their culture that we actually, most of Western civilization is based on what was done there in Athens during that time. By the time Paul got there, though, they had been conquered by the Romans, actually, like 200 years before Paul got there. But because of their glorious past, Rome allowed them to stay a free city. So they remained the center of culture and thought and architecture and government in that time while Paul was there. Their main commodity there was knowledge. That's what the Athenians wanted. They were all about learning and growing and debating. And you know what Athens kind of reminds me of? As I was studying this and going through it, I thought, Athens feels like an Ivy League campus, you know, like some kind of a college campus, doesn't it? You get that feel. Just that the main idea or the main commodity is the exchange of thoughts and ideas, and there's really great buildings, and there's people who want knowledge and discussing things and debating and taking stands. And all of that kind of breeds this idea of anything goes, doesn't it? Like, hey, you have some cool ideas? Tell me about them. I'll tell you about mine. Oh, you're great. You're fine. I'm good. We're all, you know, everything is okay. And everybody's learning from everyone else. My oldest two, Gabe and Allie, went to school in Boston. And they did not go to Harvard. But we visited Harvard's campus while we were there. And I was just marveling as I was walking around. There were beautiful buildings, and you could practically taste the knowledge in the air. You know, it was like dripping off the buildings and the ivy. And there was a definite culture and vibe to the place. And you could see from all the posters and advertisements that were hanging around that anything goes. There's, you know, this club and that religious organization, and everything was thought through and talked about and accepted. And that's Athens. That's pretty much where Paul finds himself here in chapter 17 of Acts. So what did Paul think as he was walking around the city? When I was walking around Harvard, I got to tell you, my feelings were that I was intimidated. I thought I should probably just leave here because I shouldn't be here. That's not how Paul felt. The passage says that he noticed all the idols in the city, he observed their culture, and he was what? Deeply troubled. Right? Now, the Greek, the original Greek word for that deeply troubled phrase means to irritate or provoke or arouse to anger, to scorn, despise, to exasperate, to burn with anger. So you definitely get the feeling that Paul had a passionate response to what he saw in Athens, didn't he? Now, what did he do about it? He didn't just stuff that passion. He responded. Look at the very next verse. It says that he went to the synagogue to reason with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles, and he spoke daily in the public square to all who happened to be there. Paul didn't just find some little hotel room at the local, you know, Athens Hilton and sit there with his TV on, fuming at all the idol worship he saw. He didn't do that. He had a passionate response to what he saw, and he went and did something about it. He engaged with the culture. So Paul finds himself in a culture that desperately needs Jesus. That culture, that need, arouses a passion in him, and he goes to where the people are. So let me ask you this question. What are some of the cultures you find yourself in? The ones that you have a burning passion for, the ones that you are really engaging with on a daily basis. And on your notes there, that question's at the top, it's in a little box. I want you to honestly think about that right now. What are some of the cultures you're in? And jot it in that box, and that I left you space to write in there. I'll tell you what the culture I find myself in, and I've already kind of alluded to it, with the theater and the football and the cheer. Teenagers. I love teenagers, believe it or not. I've had him living in my house for 9 years now, because Gabe's 22 and Annie's only 14, so I've got lots of years left with teenagers. God has just given me a passion for them. I love them. In fact, I always joke with my husband, Greg, and say, Greg, I don't even really like adults. I mean, adults are boring. There's no drama. What's the point, you know? But they're just great. Now, I can't really go where teenagers are so much, because it would be kind of creepy if you saw me hanging around the mall or in the, you know, high school locker rooms or something. That would just be weird. So I try to make my house somewhere where teenagers want to come so I can be with them. And that involves a lot of food, and a lot of dirty carpets and broken couches and, you know, sleepovers that I wish I would have said no to at 3 a.m, things like that. But that's my culture, and I love those kids, and that's what I have a passion for. So what about you guys? What'd you write in your box? What are some of your cultures? Just shout them out.
Tweens?
Okay, you've got that age group then. That's a rough age group. Bless your heart. That's tough. What else?
Elementary kids? Family out of state.
What's that?
Family out of state.
Family? Great.
Coworkers.
Your coworkers. I'd imagine a lot of you work, right? Those are people you're with on a daily basis all the time. I was supposed to be telling you that I was doing the same talk on Thursday, and one of the ladies yelled out, "My fox hunting club." And all the things I was imagining that you guys would be yelling at me, fox hunting club was not one of them. But how fun is that? So that's her culture, her fox hunting club. My husband Greg, he goes to Starbucks every morning at 5 a.m. Every morning at 5 a.m. God bless him. That's his thing. That's his people. It's funny, the same people go to the same Starbucks every morning at 5 a.m. And they have their own little culture. They all know each other's names. They say good morning. They sit in the same spots. They all know where they all work and everything. So Greg actually considers himself the chaplain of the 5 a.m. Starbucks people. Because they all know he works at a church, so some of them will come and talk to him sometimes. It's really cool. That's his little culture. All right, so with your culture in mind, whatever it was that you wrote on your page, let's move on in the story. Keep that in your brain, your culture, the whole time. Because here's where it really starts to get interesting. And I think we can take a lot from Paul here. Let's go on. We're starting in verse 18 now. Okay, so Paul, he also had a debate with some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. When he told them about Jesus and his resurrection, they said, "What's this babbler trying to say with these strange ideas he's picked up?" Others said, "He seems to be preaching about some foreign gods." Then they took him to the high council of the city. "Come and tell us about this new teaching," they said. "You're saying some rather strange things, and we want to know what it's all about." It should be explained that all the Athenians, as well as the foreigners in Athens, seem to spend all their time discussing the latest ideas. So what do we see Paul doing here now? We know that he already went to where the people were. He was talking with them and hanging around with them, but Paul takes things a step further here. He really dives into their culture now. How? How did Paul dive into the culture of the Athenians? Well, first of all, he was invited to a debate, and he said yes, right? Debate was definitely a part of the Athens culture. In fact, some of the books I was reading said that this high council that they took Paul to, this high council was a group of men that oversaw things in the city, things like murder trials and that kind of stuff. They were actually that kind of a council, but also one of their jobs was to approve traveling speakers that came through the town. So when these other philosophers saw Paul come in and he's talking and he had new ideas, they're thinking, well, this is a guy with some new philosophies. He's some new traveling speaker. We better go take him to the high council. We want to hear more. Let's see if the high council approves of him and if he's be allowed to speak anymore. So that's where Paul is. He finds himself at the center of culture, the culture in Athens, with all eyes and ears on him. So do you see what's happening here? The people of Athens have invited Paul into their culture, and he takes full advantage of this amazing opportunity to use that same culture to show them who the real God is. We'll see that in a minute. So to understand, though, just how brilliantly Paul maneuvers this culture, let me give you a little background on his audience. Okay, so if he's talking to this group, we know that there's probably at least three different groups of people in the audience, because it says the Epicureans, the Stoics, and then we'll assume there's just general Greek people in the audience too, right? So the Epicureans, who are they? The Epicureans were a group of philosophers who viewed reality as an endless chance combining and dispersion of atoms. Doesn't sound very exciting. Pleasure to them was achieved by living modestly and avoiding pain. So, in other words, if you're an Epicurean, the best you could do in life was to know that you are nothing more than a mass of atoms and to live simply enough to avoid pain, and that would be happiness. And then we got the Stoics. They were materialist pantheists, which means that God to them, to the Stoic, was just this idea, not really a living being. He was an idea that kind of pervaded everything. And life, therefore, was just guided by fate. So that's the Stoics. And then the Greeks. I don't probably need to tell you a whole lot about them because we all know about Greek mythology, right? The Greeks worshiped just every god they could possibly think of under the sun. Apollo and Zeus and all of that. But what's interesting is how they viewed those gods or why they worshipped all these gods. I found this little section in a book. Let me read this to you. Humans, both as individuals and as groups, paid honors to the gods to thank them for blessings received and to receive blessings in return. These honors consisted of sacrifices and gifts to the gods' sanctuaries, festivals of songs, dances, prayers, processions. In fact, a 7th century BC bronze statue, there it is, now, which is in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts now, which I'd have known, I'd have gone and seen it when I was there, a man named Manticlos made this and gave it to the sanctuary of Apollo to honor Apollo. And it makes clear why individuals gave such gifts, because on the little legs of this man, there's words printed. You probably can't see that in this picture, but he engraved these words on the statue. Manticlos did. Manticlos gave this from his share to Apollo. Now you, Apollo, do something for me in return. So this idea of reciprocation between gods and humans underlay the whole Greek understanding of how you related to gods. Gods did not love human beings, the Greeks thought. Rather, the gods supported humans who did the right things and paid them honor. And they brought terrible diseases and destruction on humans who offended them. So that's the Greek mindset in the audience. There are lots of gods, and you want to make sure that you do good things and don't tick them off. That's what the Greeks thought. All right, so now that we understand who his audience was a little better, let's read with fresh ears what it was that Paul said to them. So Paul, this is at verse 22. So Paul, standing before the council, addressed them as follows. Men of Athens, I noticed that you were very religious in every way. For as I was walking along, I saw your many shrines. And one of your altars had this inscription on it, to an unknown god. This god, whom you worship without knowing, is the one I'm telling you about. He is the God who made the world and everything in it. Since he is Lord of heaven and earth, he doesn't live in man-made temples, and human hands can't serve his needs, for he has no needs. He himself gives life and breath to everything, and he satisfies every need. From one man, he created all the nations throughout the whole earth. He decided beforehand when they should rise and fall, and he determined their boundaries. His purpose was for the nations to seek after God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him, though he's not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and exist. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. And since this is true, we shouldn't think of God as an idol designed by craftsmen from gold or silver or stone. God overlooked people's ignorance about these things in earlier times, but now he commands everyone everywhere to repent of their sins and turn to him. For he has set a day for judging the world with justice by the man he has appointed, and he proved to everyone who this is by raising him from the dead. Okay, so let's dissect this speech now by asking this question again. How did Paul dive into the culture to share Jesus with the people of Athens? Now, I see three things that he does here in the speech that I think are amazing. First thing he does, diving into the culture, is by being sensitive to the culture. In other words, by meeting them where they are. I got a question for you. What did Paul leave out of that speech we just read? What did he not say anywhere in that speech?
That they weren't wrong.
Well, that, and we're going to get to that. Whose name did you not hear? Let me ask it that way. Jesus. He didn't mention Jesus once in that speech. Why do you think that is? It's because, I'll tell you why I think it is, he was backing way up with the Athenians. He was speaking to Greeks, and they weren't ready to hear about Jesus yet because they didn't even look at the right God yet. He had to get them, like, focused on who God is before he can even bring in all the Jesus stuff, right? He was being sensitive to who he was speaking to. He had to back up and speak to them where they were intellectually. Because this speech of Paul's that we just looked at stands in stark contrast to the other speeches we see Paul make in the book of Acts. In fact, if you just back up a few verses, it's the beginning of chapter 17. We've got this example of Paul. Paul and Silas then traveled through the towns of, I don't know, something I can't pronounce, and they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. As was Paul's custom, he went to the synagogue service, and for three Sabbaths in a row, he used the scriptures to reason to the people. He explained the prophecies and proved that the Messiah must suffer and rise from the dead. He said, "This Jesus I'm telling you about is the Messiah." See, so with Jews, he was in a synagogue, he was talking to Jews. With Jews, he's able to use messianic talk. He's able to use their scriptures and the history and their prophecies to show them who this Messiah that they already know about, who this is. With the Athenians, they don't know all that stuff, right? They're not Jewish. He has to talk to them about things that they do know. Paul actually describes this technique of being sensitive to his culture in his letter to the Corinthians. Look at this. When he wrote to the Corinthians, Paul says, "Even though I am a free man with no master, I have become a slave to all people to bring many to Christ. When I was with the Jews, I lived like a Jew to bring the Jews to Christ. When I was with those who follow the Jewish law, I too lived under the law. Even though I'm not subject to the law, I did this so I could bring to Christ those who are under the law. When I am with the Gentiles," that's the Greeks, "who do not follow the Jewish law, I too live apart from that law so I can bring them to Christ. But I do not ignore the law of God, I obey the law of Christ." In other words, he doesn't do this to the point of sinning. "When I'm with those who are weak, I share their weakness, for I want to bring the weak to Christ. Yes, I try to find common ground with everyone, doing everything I can to save some. I do everything to spread the good news and share in its blessings." See, so Paul had a strategy here of being sensitive to the people and their culture. So what are some specific ways that you can be sensitive to the people in your culture? Those people you wrote down in your little square there, what are some ways that you can meet them where they are intellectually? Or negatively, what are some things that you shouldn't do that would be insensitive to your culture that you're in? I found this, and I'm almost embarrassed to put it up, but apparently there was someone somewhere, I don't even know where this came from, but he has a sandwich board on. And the sandwich board, I'm hoping you can't read it very well, because honestly, it's really offensive. He's got all these things on here, all these terrible things that he considers horrible sins, and then he's addressing people, and then at the very bottom he says, "In every other form of life that is contrary to the holy law of God, hell awaits you if you do not abandon your sins and run to Christ for mercy." Now, is that true? Yeah, but how sensitive is that? How many people are going to go, "Please, yes, please tell me"? I have to even change it because I just can't move up there. It makes me uncomfortable. But that's not sensitive. That's not sensitive to any culture, frankly. But let me try to give you a positive example. Greg, at his Starbucks, where he considers himself the chaplain, and I told you that different people will come to talk to him. A couple of years ago, a guy came up to him that he knew, and he knew his name, and they chatted before, but he said, "Hey, can I talk to you?" Sat down, tears streaming down his face, and Greg said, "Of course." And he went on to tell him that he and his wife had miscarried another baby, and just, he was heartbroken. And Greg had a choice right then. He had to think, now, what do I do in this situation? Do I start telling him, "Well, hey, you know, maybe there's sin in your life," he just had a lot of different options. He could have been insensitive, but he thought through, realized this guy wasn't anywhere spiritually yet. So all he said to him was, "Can I pray with you about it?" The guy said, "That'd be great." So they prayed together. Greg just prayed. And the end of the story is, a year or so after that, that was the beginning of this guy's journey. He and his wife now have kids, and they came to Christ. He's a believer, this guy. And it started back there because Greg was able to be sensitive and not scare him away at the very beginning. Kind of cool. All right, but let's move on. So we've seen that Paul is sensitive to his culture. That's one way that he dove into the Athenian culture. What's another way? I see Paul diving into the culture by using the culture. Or another way to say it is Paul asked himself, what's already on the minds of the Athenians that I can pull out and use to show them who Christ is or who God is? Look how he opens his speech. We already read this, but let me do it again. So Paul, standing before the council, addressed them as follows. Men of Athens, I notice that you are very religious in every way. For as I was walking along, I saw your many shrines, and one of your altars had this inscription on it to an unknown god. This god, whom you worship without knowing, is the one I'm telling you about. That is brilliant. I love, what better way to grab someone's attention than to use something from their own culture that you've already seen? Basically, Paul's saying to these guys, okay, so, hey, let's talk about you guys. Nice city, by the way. Walked around. I saw that you're very religious. I saw there's a god you're worshiping that you're not sure who that is. I happen to know who it is. Mind if I tell you about it? It's basically what Paul's doing here. It's great. He took what was already on their brains, a part of their culture, and used it to point them to the one true God. Let's just not ignore how masterful that is. He walks onto their playing field, uses their game to show them who God is. A little background on this unknown altar, or altar to an unknown God. In the 6th century BC, there was this poet and philosopher named Epimenides who lived in the Greek, in Greece. And there was this plague that had gone all throughout. And the Grecians were just trying to figure out how to get rid of it. So they would go to this god and this shrine that they knew, and they offered a sacrifice, and it didn't go away. So they went to the next god and offered a sacrifice to that god. Nope, plague's still going on. They went through all of their gods until finally this plague would not stop, and they didn't know what to do. So Epimenides said, hey, got an idea. Let's take some really hungry sheep and send them out into the countryside, because we know that really hungry sheep are just going to keep eating and eating and eating. So if these sheep happen to lay down somewhere, we'll know that that's a sign from some god that that place must be sacred. So we will go and sacrifice these sheep to that god, whoever he or she is, and then that will stop the plague. So that's what they did, and that's what happened. The plague actually did stop. So they decided that, wow, there must be some god out there that we don't know, an unknown god, and we better just worship him and keep an altar to him, otherwise he's going to strike us with some other horrible calamity. So that's the story behind that. Paul knew that, so he grabbed that little crack in their culture, that little piece of their culture and the things he saw around him. He knew it was already on their brain, and he used it to talk to them about the real God. Now here's what's really cool too. He uses even a little piece of their pop culture, doesn't he? Because look what he does here in verses 28 and 29. He says, "For in him we live and move and exist. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offering." Paul actually quotes two different poets there from their culture, which is interesting. It's sort of like him taking a movie quote in our day, or, talking about a commercial he saw on TV or something like that from our day. He takes some of their poets. That phrase, "in him we live and move and exist," is actually from a poem by Epimenides, a friend we just talked about. He had written a book, it's a poem book thing called Critia, and it contained this following section about Zeus, actually. Said, "They fashioned a tomb for thee, O holy and high one, but thou art not dead. Thou livest and abidest forever, for in thee we live and move and exist." So that's where Paul ripped that one from. And the second poet that he refers to is a guy called Artemus. And Paul quotes a portion of his poem that he wrote that says, "Let us begin with Zeus," because the Greeks believed that Zeus was the ultimate god, "whom we mortals never leave unspoken. For every street, every marketplace is filled with Zeus. Even the sea and the harbors are full of his deity. Everywhere, everyone is indebted to Zeus, for we are indeed his offspring." So that's where he grabbed that one from. So what's Paul doing here? He's pulling quotes from their culture that everyone would have been familiar with and weaving them into his explanation of who God is. And they don't even necessarily apply, do they? They're about Zeus. They weren't about the one true God. that doesn't matter. He was able to grab them because he knew that would grab their attention, grab those quotes in, twist them into meaning what he wanted them to mean so that he could talk to them about the real true God. So how do we today use parts of our culture? How can you grab things with, look at your page, who's your culture? How can you use part of that culture that you're in to talk to them about God, about Jesus? All right, so we've seen that Paul dove into the Athenian culture by being sensitive to it, by using it. And the third way I see Paul diving in is by correcting the culture. Or, as I would say, by gently instilling truth. The emphasis on gently there. Let me put up on the PowerPoint again. Those three groups we talked about a little bit earlier to refresh your memory. The Epicureans, remember? They believed that people, the earth, and life came about randomly as atoms collided. The Stoics believed that God is present in all material, not necessarily a living being, and life is guided by fate. And the Greeks felt like they had to do things for the gods and give them things so life would go well for them. All right, so now, with that in mind, let's look at Paul's speech and see if we can tell how he gently corrects some of these thoughts, some of these philosophies of the culture by instilling the truth of who God is. And I want you to notice that he's not slamming what they believe. I think we mentioned that over here earlier. He's not saying, you know, you guys are idiots. This is all wrong. You're wrong here, you're wrong here, you're wrong here. What he's doing is just speaking truth. And by speaking the truth, he's kind of showing them where they were wrong. See the difference there? So let's look and see. His very first thing he says is, he is the God who made the world and everything in it. Who do you think he's gently correcting there based on what these people believe? The Epicureans, right. Why do you think that? Because they believed what? That the world is random. So if he's the God who made everything, it's not random. He was kind of gently saying that, right? And then next he says, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, who do you think he's gently correcting there? I think maybe the Epicureans again, because again, if you're the Lord of something, that means that you're in control of it. So therefore, it can't really be random if you're in control of it, right? And the Stoics too, because if he's the God, the Lord of heaven and earth, then he's a living God who's inhabiting this, all of that. He's not just some thought we have. Then he goes on and says, Paul says, he doesn't live, this one's easier, he doesn't live in man-made temples, and human hands can't serve his needs, for he has no needs. Who's he talking to there? The Greeks, clearly. He's telling them that he's not a God that you can do things to appease. Then Paul goes on, he himself gives life and breath to everything, and he satisfies every need. Who's he talking to there? I see the Epicureans because he's kind of saying he gives life, it's not random, right? And he's talking to the Greeks too, right? Because he satisfies every need. I love that part because it's almost like he's saying to them, you don't need to meet this God's need. He's going to meet yours. Love that. He goes on, Paul, from one man he created all the nations throughout the whole earth. He decided beforehand when they should rise and fall, and he determined their boundaries. Who are you covering there? Stoics. I think so too, because he's saying that this God is the origin of all life, and it's not fate that guides things. It's God. He decided when people rise and fall. So can you see how Paul's gently correcting his culture there by just kind of, he's describing to them who this unknown God is, and in doing so, he's taking their core beliefs and he's gently saying, just let me show you this God who is different from what you were thinking. It's a nice, gentle turning of their thoughts. Love that. All right, and so, look at this next verse too. He puts the finishing touch here on his speech by bringing it all together and really appealing to the very core of who these people are and the very deepest thing they had, which was a desire for what? Knowledge. So look what he says here in this next verse. He's bringing it home now. He says, his purpose was for all the nations to seek after God. And that seek there in the original Greek actually means in the Greek, it gives you a little more understanding because it means to seek by thinking or meditating or reasoning or to inquire into. So he's getting at him about the thinking thing. His purpose was for nations to seek after God and perhaps feel their way toward him. That feel means, actually, to mentally seek after. And then toward him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. That find means to find by inquiry, thought, examination, scrutiny, observation. To see, learn, discover, understand. So you see what Paul's doing here? He's gently correcting the culture. And now with this verse, he's showing them that their very desire for knowledge was given to them by this God that they don't know so that they could learn and seek and find him with their knowledge. I mean, how cool is that? He's turning it all back around and showing them that it's their very culture that this God has created for them so they'd find him. And then he's saying, he's not very far. He's not very far from you at all. It's amazing to me that Paul is just so masterful in this. And then he drives the whole speech home. He gives it one last punch here at the end, which actually is a little bit below the belt, but I love it. I think it's awesome. He says, God overlooked people's ignorance about these things in earlier times, but now he commands everyone everywhere to repent of their sin and turn to him. What's he doing there? He's basically saying, you know, if you're really as smart as you say you are, then you have no choice but to turn to this God, isn't he? He's making a little jab at their fact that they consider themselves so knowledgeable. This just makes me want to, like, give him a standing ovation. Paul, amazing, well done, so awesome. It's amazing. So here's what we saw tonight. We saw that sharing Jesus with your culture for dummies, helpful hints from the Apostle Paul. He dove into the culture by being sensitive to it, by using it, by gently correcting it. I told my daughter, Allie, my older daughter, that I was doing this talk, you know, and what the topic was, and she reminded me that she had an amazing moment realizing how important it is to jump into the culture you're in to reach people for Christ. Last year while she was at college, Gabe and Allie went to college in Boston, like I said, at a school called Emerson College. It's a little communication arts school, and they were both musical theater majors, which you probably would have guessed. But so that was their culture, musical theater kids. And if you know anything about theater kids, it's a different culture. We're on the edge of everything, usually, especially if you're studying it at the college level, on the edge of everything morally, they're on the edge of everything. Just, it's a different culture. It's hard to talk to them about Jesus. They mostly don't want to hear it. And Allie found herself really frustrated because she really wanted to share about Christ, but had a really hard time. Especially, she had one best friend, a guy, his name was Ryan, and she spent a lot of time with Ryan, and she was really passionate about him knowing Christ, and just didn't get an opportunity to talk to him, hardly ever. And so, but one day, that changed in one of her classes, her acting class, and she gave me permission to read her journal entry from that day. Just think it's a cool example of diving into the culture to share Jesus. And this is from February 20th, 2014, so like a year ago, almost exactly. She says, God is so good. Emerson College is such a dark place. I see and hear horrific things, and I live in the center of all of the darkness and insecurity. I felt it was my mission to love fully and point people to Jesus. Today I learned that pointing is all it takes. God reminded me that he is the one who guides, who pushes, and who opens eyes. All I have to do is simply be truthful with my words and the way that I live. Today in acting class, I was to recite my voice poem. Little aside, they had this assignment where they had to write a poem that was metaphorical and represented who they are and how they relate to the world around them and how they hear and react with the world. And then they had to recite it in class while looking at everyone in the eye. They couldn't break eye contact. So today I had to recite my voice poem. It's a poem we had written in class about our voice in the abstract sense of the word. Here's what I had written. It flies high, no doubt. It's strong and sure. It's fun and free, but conditioned by its surroundings. The kite builder conducts it smoothly, navigation on point. But the wind pushes back. It comes from all angles and pushes back. It says, too much, too loud, in the way. It asks, aren't you tired? And laughs in large gusts. And the kite sinks lower than its original low. But he had created it to fly high. I created you for whimsy, for joy, and for hope. I created you so your vibrant colors would show. He had created it to fly high. And then she says, Melissa, who is the professor, I guess they call them by their first names. Melissa had the chair set up in a horseshoe shape. She asked someone to be the first in sharing our poems for the class. I felt a tug on my heart to be the first to go for this voice project, so I went up to the middle of the room and did my poem. It was shockingly emotional to speak these words to a room of people while making eye contact. After saying the poem, I had to explain to the class what it meant to me and what I intended by the metaphor. It was so nerve-wracking to explain to the class where I get my identity and how God is my everything, or rather, is everything. I hadn't spoken that aloud to a group at Emerson, well, ever. It was strangely freeing and made me homesick. I missed talking about Jesus. She had me do my poem again, and I did it through a crackling voice. I could see four or five people in the room were beginning to cry. Ryan was in the audience, sobbing. Melissa had me sit in a chair in front of the class to receive feedback. Sheba raised her hand and told me that seeing my faith reminded her of a faith she used to have. Others said similar things, and I began to see the power of speaking in a truthful way. I realized the impact that art can have on artists. It made working on all of this meaningful and impactful. Ryan raised his hand and was weeping. He looked at me and told me through tears that he gets it now. He said he understands a big faith, and he wants to have faith like that. He said that watching how I love God made him rethink what he believes. This was so incredible and impactful. And then she has some bullet points of things she learned. Change is possible here. Art is important. Truth is impactful and can change hearts. I can impact artists with art. And God will truly carry you and guide you through what he wants from you. I just think that's a really cool example of taking the culture you're in and then diving into it and allowing that to break open the door so you can tell people who Jesus is, because otherwise they may not even listen. So who's on your page? Who'd you write on there? Why don't you close your eyes for a minute? Picture some of the faces of the people that are in that culture of yours that you wrote on your page. Is the Holy Spirit nudging you right now, kind of giving you ideas of ways that you can be sensitive to the culture? You can use the culture, you can gently correct that culture. Let him talk to you, and I'm going to pray for us. So Jesus, thank you. Thanks for Paul. Thanks for his wisdom and his just beautiful way of talking to people differently with different people that he was with. God, let us follow that example and do everything so that others may know you, like Paul said. And Jesus, I just pray for these ladies as they're going out into their lives and into the different cultures of people that they interact with. Just give them your strength, your power. Holy Spirit, be with them. And we love you so much. Amen. Thanks, Lee.